Good afternoon. So we have our diehard activists here. Thank you for being here. I try to rustle some people up at the pool. I guilted them. I think they'll be coming in. I was fairly aggressive. So this is the closing panel before we get to the end of what's been an amazing conference. I think you'll all agree very robust science was presented here and amazing discussions. It's my honor to present to deliver a plenary address, Dr. Julio Montaner, who's the director of the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS, chair in AIDS research and head of the Division of AIDS and Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia. He's very well recognized globally for his contributions through research, but more importantly, as a leader in helping to set concrete targets for us to reach to end AIDS as a public health threat by 2030. Most notably, the 90-90-90 targets. He's co-chair of the UNAIDS Scientific and Technical Advisory Committee, and under his leadership, along with Kenley Sequese, has done such incredible work to point us in the direction of achieving the targets we're attempting to achieve. So, Julio, will you please honor us with your plenary?
Thank you, Jose, and thank you, IAPAC, for having me to deliver these closing comments, if you want. I do so with great honor, and it makes me particularly humble to give these remarks in front of David Birx, who has been really the champion on making all of our dreams become a reality. So thank you, David, for your tremendous work. As always, I will give you a fairly biased perception of what I think has been going on and has been happening. Before we go there, let me share with you my conflict of interest disclosure as shown here, and briefly outline the learning objectives. Pretty simplistically, I'll go over the treatment prevention story, the 90-90-90 target, the feasibility of the 90-90-90 target in rich and resource-limited settings, and then make a few comments regarding the 90-90-90 as it pertains to ending the AIDS pandemic. Our engagement with this strategy came out of nowhere, to be honest with you. We were sitting pretty happy in 1996 with the announcement of triple therapy as the new standard of therapy at the Vancouver International AIDS Conference. Because the conference served as a magnet for dissemination of this new science, then very briskly, with the support of the provincial government, which has been terrific over the years and decades, we roll out antiretroviral therapy free of charge for all HIV-infected individuals. As you remember, originally we were less concerned about CD4s. I wish we would have stayed there. In any case, what happened was we roll out antiretroviral therapy, and lo and behold, within a few years, we came across this chart as part of our monitoring and evaluation strategies. And what we saw was something that we did not expect. Syphilis rate, as it had been happening throughout North America and elsewhere, were continued to grow since 1996, and HIV new diagnosis, despite increased testing efforts, was actually going down. And interestingly enough, it had flattened after the year 1999, where controversies around antiretroviral therapy had led us to slow down the recruitment of people on the HIV program. That's when we redeploy our resources to look at the ecological impact of antiretroviral therapy in British Columbia and elsewhere, and also internationally, accessing data in the public domain. And between a re-examination of our cohorts and the ecological data from elsewhere, we came to the conclusion that treatment would have to be playing a role until then not fully understood in preventing HIV transmission to explain the findings that we ultimately describe in our Lancet 2006 paper, which was followed shortly thereafter by Ruben Granich's separate and independent modeling work that actually confirmed the same viewpoint. The province of British Columbia, as I said, was very generous on their support of our antiretroviral therapy effort. And so immediately when we brought the data that I just shared with you to their attention, the government, through different initiatives and different ways, they agreed to expand antiretroviral therapy access in the province, as you see in this slide. So following January 2004, when we shared this data with them, the use of antiretroviral therapy was liberalized incrementally over the years. And you see here that treatment of prevention basically was born in our jurisdiction. The impact of bringing the services to the people in a supportive fashion, everything from testing to support to management and antiretroviral therapy, had a dramatic effect on both mortality, as you see in the green, and AIDS incidence, as you see in the orange. So much so that a couple of years ago, we actually formally closed our AIDS ward, not because we wanted to close it, but we needed to repurpose for other issues. There was no longer a need for it. I'm happy to report that survival in this cohort has continued to increase, and even as recently as in the last few years, we have seen nearly a doubling of the life expectancy of individuals treated with antiretroviral therapy in British Columbia. Currently, Bob Hogg, our demographer, tells me that the expected life expectancy at age 20 is in the order of 55 years. With immediate antiretroviral therapy, that is. And as you are familiar with, we saw a remarkable association between expansion of antiretroviral therapy coverage on the red and new diagnosis on the blue, in such a way that for every 1% increase in the coverage with antiretroviral therapy, our model tells that there is a 1% decrease in the HIV incidence or HIV new diagnosis, whichever measure you want to use. In a setting, as I said before, of ever-increasing HIV testing. The beauty of all of this is that things, as a result of the expansion of the program, having done this with the appropriately supported way, we have seen improvements in the cascade of care in every single domain. This is something that Boranossi from our group reported in 2014. I show you here the adherence data showing that despite the fact that we're engaging people in much more challenging environments, socioeconomical, culturally, et cetera, we are seeing a very remarkable increase in the adherence rates, which ultimately translates on biologic suppression and a decreasing amount of drug resistance. I emphasize all of this because there have been recent reports that the expansion of programs elsewhere has been associated with unfavorable outcomes with regards to adherence, viral suppression, resistance, and although I respect the fact that that may happen, that doesn't need to happen, that shouldn't happen, that we cannot afford that to happen. If we are going to expand our programs, we have to do that in a sturdy fashion so that the outcomes are the best we possibly can deliver. More recently, we have added additional efforts to try to track the epidemic in British Columbia. This is a near real-time monitoring of HIV transmission using phylogenetics to try to identify the hotspots using phylogenetic data throughout the province, and then use these to inform where the next steps should be taken. As you can imagine, having gone from nearly 800 to 900 new infections per year to now a low 200, we have an obligation to better understand what's happening where and when if we're going to be able to deploy resources smartly in a geographic locale as immense as British Columbia is, with such a relatively small population. That's at the populational level. At the more individual level, we're also in a position to use the standard of care genotyping that we do for everybody infected with HIV in the province to feed into the real-time phylogenetic monitoring, as illustrated in this chart, which I'm not going to go into details. This was published the first week of April this year in the Lancet HIV. And what this shows is one particular a cluster in the province of British Columbia where you see the cases have been coded in the three rectangles that you see on the bottom, with red people with resistant virus, with green people with sensitive virus or wild-type virus. The shadow dots pertain to individuals who belong to the cluster but they have a disease. And then the size of the circles shows the viral load of the particular individual. The ones that have a second circle indicates that that's a current new diagnosis. And so what you see there is that we get a cluster. It's a pretty bad cluster. It has a lot of red in it. So in a non-nominal fashion, we're able to use this as a stepping point for public health interventions, a number of them that are currently being done under the auspices of our public health officer and the attorney general, because, of, as you can imagine, there are significant considerations around criminalization of HIV exposure in this context. And to make a long story short, what I wanted to share with you is the middle panel, which shows that through concerted public health efforts, using antiretroviral therapy as a key tool, we are able to shut down that cluster, at least partially. You see that it's only one active case in that middle phase. But I wanted to highlight the fact that, lo and behold, the cluster reactivates, requiring further action. And you notice that it's now predominantly wild-type, although there is some resistant virus being spread. I think that this is a very unique approach that helps us to gain very detailed understanding of what's happening where and how we can smartly deliver resources to try to affect these mini outbreaks. We're currently talking to the public health officer of British Columbia to expand the reportable definition to every single detectable viral load in a previously undetectable patient. We feel that from a transmission perspective, it plays the same role, and if we do so, we will add another layer to our ability to better target our resources. So all of this to say that a couple of years ago, Michelle Sidibe, on behalf of the UNAIDS, came to a number of us to ask us to try to build on the lessons learned from our treatment and prevention work to try to come up with a tangible target that could replace the 2015 antiretroviral therapy target. And after a lot of long nights and discussions, we reached consensus on the new ambitious treatment target that would be put forward to hopefully help us write the final chapter of the AIDS epidemic or AIDS as a public health threat. And that's, as you know, the 90-90-90. The idea is that by 2020, we're calling for globally 90% of the people at least be diagnosed, at least 90% of them to be on sustainable high-quality treatment, and at least 90% of them to be virologically suppressed on a sustained basis. If we're able to achieve that, we will achieve 73% of the global prevalent cases of HIV to be virologically suppressed. And this could change the course of the epidemic in ways that you are now familiar with. The plots here were generated by John Stover, who we asked to conduct an independent validation of the 90-90-90 target. As you see here, on your left-hand side, AIDS death would be predicted to go steadily up, as shown by the red line, in the absence of a more aggressive rollout of antiretroviral therapy. If we meet the 90-90-90 by 2020, there would be a sharp decrease in AIDS death and then a continued decline thereafter, so that we would have approximately a 90% or somewhere in the neighborhood or a 90% decrease in AIDS death going forward. The same could be said for AIDS incidence, by the way. I want to stress and remind you at the same time, for those of us that don't often read the fine printing, that the 90-90-90 becomes 95-95-95 by 2030, and that's something to keep in mind. With regards to new infections, the same pattern develops. You see, in the absence of a concerted effort on the green, the new infections will continue to rise. If we deliver on the 90-90-90, it would come down as shown here in the blue line, and again, approximately an order of magnitude decrease. So we would be on target to achieve what we set out ourselves to achieve, which is a 90% decrease in global burden of HIV/AIDS through a new antiretroviral therapy target, the so-called 90-90-90. This was enthusiastically endorsed by a high level representative meeting that took place at the UN in September 2014. In fact, John Kerry was there, and he was the first one that stood up to embrace the 90-90-90 target. A number of others did thereafter, and ultimately the 90-90-90 moved on to become part of the conversation around the Sustainable Development Goals. As you know, last September at the UN, the Sustainable Development Goals were agreed upon, and under number three, good health and well-being, the end of AIDS has been now formally included. We'd like to believe that the 90-90-90 is the roadmap to fulfilling the goal number three as it relates to AIDS, and we hope that this will be confirmed at the upcoming HLM in June at the United Nations. So the question really that I was asked to address is whether or not this is feasible. And I think it's one of those things that it has to be. We think it is. We know it is. We have data to suggest that we are getting there. But to be perfectly honest with you, if we want to change the path of the AIDS pandemic globally, we have to move in the direction of the 90-90-90. And I hate to be worrywart, but it's now middle of May of 2016, and time is running out for us to meet the 90-90-90. Political statements of support and otherwise are very welcome, but the time is now on for us to deliver on the 90-90-90 as opposed to keep on talking about it. So in our own program, the Province of British Columbia, we have looked at the 90-90-90 using two different approaches. This is using the 90% diagnosed, 90% on antiretroviral therapy, and 90% suppressed version of the analysis. And you can see here that the trends are actually quite encouraging. The diagnosed are going up, currently over 80%. The on ART, the gap between diagnosed and on ART is shrinking. That is from the blue to the red. And then once on treatment, the rates of suppression that we're seeing are quite encouraging as well. As you see in the next slide, if we now depict this, all of them, as function of the 90% target, we see that the diagnosed and the on treatment are slightly under approximately 80%. The suppressed are in excess of 90%. So if current trends continue, Viviani Diaz-Lima, our modeler, tells me that by 2018, she expects that we will have met the 390s. Let's see if we can get there. So the question that I often get asked is whether or not this is something that could be reproduced elsewhere. And I'm not going to go into a whole lot of data. I'm aware that the ambassador has now shared with you some of their PEPFAR data, suggesting that programs in many places around the world are moving in the direction of meeting the 90-90-90. I'll share a few examples for you. This is San Francisco, where, as you know, Test and Treat Initiative has been in place for a number of years now and is showing good progress regarding declining HIV new infections in the setting of expansion of antiretroviral therapy. This is a new paper that came out actually this week, May the 9th, also from the Lancet, in this case, ID. And what it did is look at the Danish HIV epidemic in MSM specifically, and it shows the increasing proportion of MSM infected with HIV who are accessing antiretroviral therapy, and the progressive decline in number of new diagnoses in MSM. And the paper goes on to conclude that it is very likely that the Danish will be meeting the 90-90-90 anytime soon. So the next question is whether or not this is something that could be expected to be operational in the south of the world. And one of the first papers that offer me great reassurance in that regard is shown here from Science in 2013, where the KwaZulu-Natal group reported on the impact of expanding antiretroviral therapy coverage as a function of new diagnosis. And Without getting into the details of the analysis, which is quite elegant, by the way, the beauty of it to me was that their model showed that for every 1% increase in treatment coverage, they had a 1% decline in HIV incidence, which is exactly the same association that we had shown earlier on in the British Columbia treatment program, indicating that at the end of the day, these things work just the same in the north, in the south. The issue is, can we go out and roll out antiretroviral therapy massively as the UNH 90-90-90 target is recommending? And in that context, Max Essex has now published his paper from Botswana, where using the data from a much larger clinical trial that they're doing, reanalyzing the data to try to establish where Botswana is at the present time, they came to the conclusion that they're not quite at the 90-90-90, but they're actually getting pretty close. At the present time, they are 83% diagnosed for a goal of 90%, 73 almost percent of people on treatment for a goal of 81%, that's the 90% or 90% diagnosed, and 70% suppressed viral load, that's 70% out of a goal of 73%, which would be the 90% or 90% or 90% for viral suppression, the 73% that I referred to earlier. So to make a long story short, we now have evidence from the north and the south that the strategy actually works. It can not only work, but it works to the same extent, and that it can work very well indeed, even in resource-limited settings. So the final question is, can we afford it? And of course, most of us, we feel that we cannot not do this, and that the price should be a secondary consideration. But the good news is that this is a cost-saving matter. Ruben Granich actually made that point very elegantly in this modeling paper, looking at expanding antiretroviral therapy in South Africa over a time frame of 2010 to 2050. And as you see, going from the green to the orange to the yellow to the blue, moving the CD4 count target up, and ultimately to move to the test and treat on the blue, would save over 5 million lives over that period of time. But the important issue is the money. And the money, as shown here, says that in the short term, going after a test and treat or universal treatment for everybody infected with HIV will cost a little bit more, but in the very near future, this becomes actually cost neutral, and immediately thereafter actually cost averting, largely because of the impact that treatment has immediately on declining HIV transmission. And so while the impact at the individual health level is very important and it makes the treatment worth pursuing on its own right, what changes the value proposition of the strategy is that it virtually stops transmission. And all of this has now been demonstrated in clinical trials, HPTN052, START, Temprano. The evidence is overwhelming. There is no room to hide. This is the only way forward. Speaking of HPTN052, I'll remind you that there is a cost-effective analysis that was published by Rochelle Walensky from this study, showing quite clearly that whether it's in South Africa or in India, at the very least, the treatment prevention over a limited period of time using clinical trial data would be deemed to be at least cost-effective, if not cost-averting in some settings. In our own experience, Bob Nosek, our health economist, has recently published our real data driven Greenwich-style curve. And what you see here on the red is that going for the full test and treat has already put us in a situation where we are saving money, and going forward, we are actually saving millions of dollars as a result of the morbidity and mortality that did not materialize consequent to the expansion of treatment and prevention. It's been a long and hard battle, and a number of you here in the audience deserve the credit for rallying behind the notion that treatment prevention could change the course of the epidemic. We've been everywhere, and I use the Pope here because he was the last one that we wanted to conquer in order to ensure that we can have maximum penetration of antiretroviral therapy through the religious networks, particularly in poor areas of the world. And it was a huge victory for us. I am ashamed to say that despite this victory, Canada lagged behind significantly, not British Columbia, but the country, until very recently. Justin Trudeau, as you know, is our new rock star, our prime minister. The guy is tremendous. He's incredibly willing to listen and to pay attention to the evidence. He has engaged with us now for a number of months on these issues, even before the election. His Minister of Health, Jane Philpott, is actually a person that spent years working in AIDS in Africa, so she knows what she's talking about when she says, as she did on December 1st, 2015, that Canada now formally embraces the 90-90-90. I'm sorry to be so parochial about it, but it took us a long time to get the Canadian government to do something about it. And finally, they did it on May the 9th. Justin Trudeau increased the pledge to the Global Fund by 20%, something that makes us very proud, finally, after a decade of fighting the federal government. Unfortunately, that's not good enough. We need more, and we don't apologize for being demanding. In order to stop the epidemic, we're going to need a lot more Trudeaus around the world, and I'm hoping that with you, we will be in Durban to mobilize the forces being to ensure that this actually happens. The lesson for me on all of this is that we have an opportunity to implement treatment prevention to end AIDS as a public health threat. But beyond that, we have an opportunity to use treatment prevention as a strategy for targeted disease elimination that will promote better outcomes, better public health, and ultimately healthcare sustainability. And Canada, because of our social medicine program, needs this desperately. And I believe that this could benefit many countries around the world, including the United States. I will take the liberty to actually highlight in the fact that this may be highly effective not only for infectious diseases, but also for diseases that are transmitted through social contagion. That could be addictions-related medicine, that could be nutrition-related medicine, obesity, hypertension, and the like. It could be smoking-related diseases. There are a number of diseases that we can imagine that whereby there is a social contagion element such that if we decrease prevalence of the condition, you may actually get a decrease in incidence, and in doing so, the return on the investment of optimized targeted disease eliminations could be remarkable. And that's something that we're currently working on beyond HIV in our center. So to the question that Jose posed to me, what does it mean ending AIDS in the context of the 90-90-90? Well, it means ending the pandemic. We're not talking about eradicating HIV. We're not talking about eradicating AIDS. We're talking about transforming what it was a public health threat, a pandemic, into a low-grade endemic disease that may be lower level in some areas than others, depending on how much effort we put in rolling out our 90-90-90 target. In order to end this story altogether, we're going to need much more than treatment prevention, including a cure and or a vaccine that are highly effective. Unfortunately, we don't see that in the cards at the moment, so ending AIDS as a public health threat should be our immediate next goal. Thank you.